Hi, and welcome to the podcast. My name is Becky, and I'm wearing my sparkling, shimmering dress and my dancing shoes. And over here is Cedric Skysetti, and he is playing 20 instruments all at one time.
And I'm wearing a tuxedo.
And he's wearing a tuxedo, yeah. No sparkling dress for him. And you are listening to the Happy Project Podcast. Listen.
What am I hearing? Listening to what?
You know. You're listening to...
Yeah.
Oh, it is.
The Happy Project.
The Happy Project Podcast.
Yeah.
Hey, Cooks.
What's up?
I have a question for you.
Okay.
Have you ever listened to the Korean trot style of music?
Of course.
Yeah. Can you give us an example?
No. Oh, no. How about I'll hum an example
because oh, okay.
I don't know any lyrics anything.
Yeah, but. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, oh, hey.
What is that?
Let's try. Or trottu.
I did not get. Wait, is that a real song?
No.
Oh,
I'm off the dome here.
You know, trot like it does a lot of that. That kind of beat, like, oh my, I don't know how you.
Well, now you do it.
I'm trying to hear it in my head. I was thinking like, yeah, something a little bit like that, okay?
Yeah.
And trot music, you're gonna have a lot of, I always see disco lights playing in my head when
yeah.
I hear when I think
kind
of
like
trot.
A cheesy karaoke, like an old style karaoke.
Yeah, but you know what? That used to be the jam back in the day in Korea. And it's kind of making a comeback now. You know, they have like Mr. Trot, like that Korean show where you have like all these young singers coming out singing, you know, classic trot music. Trot is not the style of music we're talking about today, but it is rooted. I guess trot music is kind of rooted in Western influences of music, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if we kind of follow that thread all the way back to where it began, we might see the root of where our topic kind of originated from. Those Western influences of music in Korea.
Right. That's a nice little segue there.
Oh, thank you. Well, if you guys haven't figured it out by now, and you know, to be honest, I don't know how you would because that was extremely vague, the description. But today we are talking about a very interesting trio of singers who came from Korea and made their way all the way to the United States. You might even say they were the first K-pop girl group to really make it big.
Absolutely. And I have to say that I literally don't think I've ever heard of them. Or if I did, I just kind of brushed past it.
Yeah.
But it's not even in my memory until you had the idea for this podcast episode.
Yeah, I can't even remember how I came across them. And I guarantee you there's a good number of people out there who have never heard of them before despite how big they were at the time. And okay, we'll stop vamping. Today we are going to be talking about the Kim sisters. I've heard of them.
Yeah.
But today we're just going to tell you all about them. And you might discover a new favorite musical group.
I know I have. Like, I'm sorry, but I think I'm in love.
Like,
if anyone knows me from back in the day, you know. I'm like huge.
She's cute.
K-pop. Like, I'm like
she's pretty.
First. Oh yeah, of course. I'm like the first wave of K-pop, like super fan.
This is
back
the
in
first,
the 90s.
First wave.
Yeah, yeah. And so I would just fall in love with all these girl groups. I mean, the guy groups were cool too. But like, oh man, like Finkel was my jam.
Okay.
Right? Ihyori was my favorite, of course. Had posters all on my wall.
I mean, he still does.
Yes, but I don't know. I just fall in love with these girl groups. Or I used to, I should say. Right? And
that's
so like,
cool.
I think now… Those old feelings or that old habit of falling in love with girl groups happened to me again.
Wow.
But it's a little different now because this is like kind of like retroactively, I don't know if that's the right way to put it, falling in love.
Whoa.
Like, what because we're going back in the past.
Oh, so you're jumping in love.
I'm jumping in love into the past as if I lived in the past and fell in love with this girl group. So this is how much impact they made on me in the last couple of days.
This is not what I expected when we decided to do this topic. Okay, well, that's great to hear.
Okay.
That you're in love with the Kim sisters. And by the end of this episode, all of you guys will be too. So the Kim sisters, their title, yes, it is called Kim sisters, but actually they were made up of two sisters and a cousin. She was later adopted in as a sister. And the three girls who made up this group was Kim Sukja, or as she was known in the US as just Su, Kim Eja, and she was also known as Eja, and their cousin Kim Minja, or also known as Mia. So we might refer to them as Su, Sukja, Mia, Minja, but at least now you know who we're talking about. Well, to figure out where they came from literally and also musically where they were developed, it's important to talk about who their parents were.
Yeah. So their father was actually a famous composer and his name was Kim Hye-sung.
Yeah.
Which is funny because song is like, you know.
Song.
Yeah, song, right? Mm. But yeah, he was born in 1911 in North Korea, and this is prior to the two different Koreas. So yeah. I mean, Korea was just one big peninsula at the time. And he was actually credited for bringing jazz into Korea.
Yeah.
And he was also, I mean, to the point of being nicknamed the genius of jazz.
The genius of jazz. And you know, you think about it at that time, 1920s, 1930s. This was kind of his heyday. I guess 1930s more. Mm-hmm. When you think about 1920s, 1930s music style, a lot of times that come to your mind are what was influenced from the US, right?
Right.
You've got big band, you've got like the Great Gatsby kind of style of stuff happening. Maybe the Rat Pack beginning, these kind of musical influences. This is in the West. But you're thinking about Korea, 1910, 1920s, 1930s. You've got a lot of folk music happening. This is a lot of music that was… it was a way to rally the local Korean people against the Japanese influences. So a lot of heartfelt things. Turot was also coming into the picture, sort of. Ballads. These kind of things. But if you look up Kim Hye-sung's music, it's so vastly different from what you envision of the style of Korean music at that time.
Right. I mean, it kind of reminds me of some of the, I guess, like theater performances that you see in Korea, like the comedic sort I guess in a way slapstick, like kind of like that style. Like, I guess that's how I think of Kim Hye-sung's music.
Yeah.
Right. At least the very little bit that I've heard. And you can actually find some of it on YouTube.
Look it up.
It's crazy.
It's so great. And you were totally right by saying that slapstick, because he was also very well known for not just his jazz. Mm-hmm. And if you look up some of his songs, there's one, you guys, if you want to get a good view for what he sounds like, it's called Cheongchun Gaegeup. I don't know what it is in English, but if you listen to it, it'll straight up sound like you're listening to like Count Bessie or something. It's like something you would hear out of Great Gatsby movies. But he was also known for Manyu, which is what you're referring to. These songs that originated during the Japanese occupation. And they had a lot of comedic lyrics and joking around.
Yeah.
Great example is, it's a 전화 읽기. That is one song of his that is a good example of this. And there's lots of silly, funny, you know, jokes in there. And it's a really funny song. And he mixes in English and Korean to great effect. And that is one of his two songs that were actually banned at the time because it just caused so much public disturbance.
And what's so funny about that is when you listen to it, you're like… I don't know. If you picture a song like modern day song that would cause a public disturbance, you're thinking like maybe hard rock, like screamo or something.
Right,
like,
right.
You
people
know,
are moshing in public.
I don't
or
know.
Something
but
like that.
Yeah, but I mean, you got to think that, you know, during this time, this is in the thick of the Japanese occupation.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
When these songs were actually released.
Right. So 전화 읽기 is a good example as well if you want to hear like the kind of joking style. It's so cute too because like he really writes in using English but like Koreanized.
Mm-hmm.
See, it's very tongue-in-cheek, right? It's very cheeky music. And also he was a very… Beyond those kind of things, he was also just a great composer. And so a lot of his songs were what brought some Korean folk singers to today who are so legendary. It was his songs that they became famous for performing, you know, that specific song. So Kim Hye-sung was very influential. And we'll mention a little bit more about him later that was very significant in the development of the Kim sisters. But
Absolutely.
Now let's talk about their mother.
Okay, yeah. So in 1936, Kim Hye-sung actually married Lee Nan-young, who was at the time the most famous female singer.
Yeah.
So as you can see, the roots run deep with music in the family.
Yeah.
And so she was also known for the song Mokpo-ye Nunmul, which is translated Tears in Mokpo.
Yeah.
And that's actually on YouTube as well.
It's a great song.
Yeah. So I got a chance to listen to, I guess, one of the… It may have been the original recording of it.
Oh, okay.
But also, like, you could see her perform it in her later years as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, they married and that was a big deal, right? For this great composer, this great singer. So, at this time, 1936 is when they married. And the interesting thing about Lee Nan-young is she was part of the very first Korean girl group. They apparently formed in 1939. I don't know what happened to them, but yeah, they were the very first of all. And I want to just double check that writing I wrote in there because it says 저고기 시스터즈, but I don't think that's correct.
Okay.
So I'm just going to look up really fast. What was it? 저고리.
저고리. Not that meat.
That sisters. Meat sisters. Yeah. 저고리 sisters. I think there is an autocorrect that happened there.
Yeah. Well, thanks for clarifying.
Yeah, people are looking up 저고기 sisters. But yeah, 저고리 sisters. And they formed in 1939. The very first Korean girl group.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah, so they obviously had some sick collabs back in the day, you know, after they got married. So he ended up writing 다방에 푸른 꿈 for his wife in 1939.
Yeah, and that's the title of the documentary that came out.
Oh, really?
About the Kim sisters in like 2015, I think. So 다방에 푸른 꿈 was the name of the documentary as
okay.
well.
Very cool.
Yeah, and we can mention that again later. But they had a total of 12 children, which is a lot of kids. This plays a role later on as well.
Mm-hmm.
But only 7 of those survived. And apparently 6 of them became very excellent musicians. The one, who knows what happened to them?
Yeah. Kind of the runt of
the family. Yeah, okay. Who knows what they're doing? But anyway, 6 of them were very great musicians. Now, here's the thing, the kind of the crux of the moment. Kim Hye-sung, he was making an orchestra. I think this was right after the 1945. I think the end of the war. Or I'm sorry, the end of liberation.
Mm-hmm.
He was performing for the American troops. He made an orchestra that was just for the American troops. And so a lot of his music was a big blend of Korean and American music styles. And he was doing this, that's what he was really well known for. And it says that due to his work with the American troops, because he was so close to them, performing for them and this kind of thing, he was actually kidnapped by North Korea in 1950.
Man.
And then it was some years later, his death was reported. Whether that is true or not, nobody knows. But as you can imagine, this was a huge, huge shock to a family of 12 and Lee Nan-young, his wife.
Right. And I'd imagine even to the people that knew of him because he was a very well-known composer and an artist of his own. So now you're left with a family of 7 and a mother, a single mother. And during that time, it's like, you know, what am I going to do? The husband, the breadwinner is gone.
Yeah.
Right. So…
Well, laying the foundation to Korea at that time. This is post the split, North and South Korea, after the war. Total devastation. So regardless of her, Lee Nan-young, being a well-famous singer, everybody was just poor.
Right.
So they were really struggling.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a very good point. So, she had to figure out a way to obviously supply for her family on her own. And so this is where she had the idea of really raising up her kids as artists.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where she developed essentially the group, the Kim Sisters.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is where she would really begin to train them. But I mean, before we get into that, let's talk about the fact that Lee Nan-young would get American music from the black market.
Yeah.
Which was like surprising for me to hear.
Yeah.
And she would teach her girls how to sing from this music.
Yeah.
And obviously they can't speak English, especially the girls. I don't know about…
I don't think she ever learned.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, which would make sense, right?
Yeah.
And so imagine, you know, her just phonetically writing out the lyrics.
Yes.
And teaching her kids that. And
right.
not only that, but figuring out musically like how to play the music and
yeah.
how to teach them to play the music.
She was clearly a musical genius of her own right because like you mentioned the black market. What this was it was a black market thriving around American military bases. So this is where Koreans could trade for things or buy items that were coming through the American troops and their bases that you
right.
couldn't find outside of there. So this is where she would get, Lee Nan-young would get musical records of American style music. And she would listen to them over and over and over again. And she would phonetically write down the lyrics and how to do the songs and teach her children to sing these songs phonetically. It's really, I can't even imagine her doing that. Like it's so brilliant and also so much determination.
Right.
Right. But she figured this is the way to keep her family alive. Use my talent, which is music, and from their father, which was music. And apparently he really trained them all from a very young age to love music and have a musical ear. And then use that as a way to provide for the family. And how are they going to do that?
Right.
Yeah. There was a quote here that I pulled out. I can't remember who was the one who said it. I think maybe it was Sukta. But she was saying what they would do is they would learn these songs and they would go and perform at the military bases, the American military bases. And they didn't get any money for it, but the soldiers would give them bottles of whiskey
mm-hmm.
or chocolates, things like that, which were very valuable outside of the military base. And then they would trade that for rice to keep the family alive. So this is kind of where it began.
Right. Yeah. So as you can see, like the family is essentially desperate to survive,
yeah.
right? To keep the food on the table. So Lee Nan-young, she made sure that she kept the family trained up, made them train
mm-hmm.
Because she also knew that in order to stand out, they had to be excellent
yeah.
in what they did. And they also had to bring something different to the table other than just singing. Because
yeah.
anyone with musical talent can at least sing.
Yeah.
And so what is very interesting, and it'll come into play in our conversation a little later, is she had this idea that her daughters had to, and even her sons,
yeah.
had to bring something more to the table
yeah.
than just singing. And
right.
so she made them actually, or she actually taught them how to play 20 different instruments.
So crazy.
Right.
Yeah.
And so among the 20, we have saxophone, trombone, flute, banjo, guitar, clarinet, accordion, marimba. Maybe you
Bag
could take
vibes.
It over here.
Yeah. No, I'm reading this again. I'm like, where did they learn all this? The bagpipes, the piano, the mandolin, the violin, kayagum, drums, changgu. So of course, some
yeah.
of these instruments their mom must have taught them, like the kayagum and changgu maybe. And then of course, over the years, the girls, and I guess their brothers too, would learn over 20 different instruments. Either amongst them or they all learned them all.
Right. And when I first heard about this, I was like…
No way.
Like I could see you learning 20 different instruments, but to play it proficiently…
Yeah.
I'm like, no way. But
no way.
You'll see in our future or later conversation.
Yeah. Or you got to watch them on YouTube.
Oh,
you're going to see
like,
they're constantly pulling out a new instrument.
And at first, they're insane, man.
At first you giggle a little bit. Like you see one girl with a banjo and you're just like, oh, haha, yeah. And then the other two come out with banjos and then they start playing like really well. It's so… You start with giggling and then it ends up with admiration.
Mm-hmm.
They had quite that surprise factor. So the Kim sisters, like we mentioned before, Minja, she was the cousin. I don't know exactly what ages they were when they actually formed the group. I have read they were 9 years old. I've also read that Sukja was 12, Aja was 11, Minja was 10. Either way, they were very, very young. And just to kind of give an idea of how incredibly poor they were, how desperate their situation was, at this time they were all living in a brick storage unit with her family, with Lee Nan-young's family, and 22 other people. They were all living in there because their family home had been burnt down by North Korean soldiers. So they had no home. They were just living in this place with all these other people. There was no bathroom. Sometimes they went for days without food. This is how desperate they were when In Yan Young started training up these girls. And I'm sure she probably recognized like, oh, you know what? They got something special. And then Min Jia, who was her niece, she probably brought her into the group as well, thinking they got something. And so they started to perform around the military camps in Korea, all over the place. I think the first place they performed was Daegu, from what I read somewhere. And some of our sources come from either the Kim sisters' website themselves or a documentary about them or interviews, as well as Korean blogs that I was finding that talked about them. Surprising how sparse the information is about the Kim sisters, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, as they're performing for, you know, in their, I guess, adolescent, younger teenage years, you know, I was able to see that I think through one of the videos I was watching, like the soldiers, a lot of the soldiers just loved them.
Yeah.
Right? Because they were like the little sisters that they had back at home.
Oh.
You know what I mean? So they were received really well.
Yeah.
I mean, but well deserved because they were truly talented even at that young age.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they had tight harmonies, they had great voices. And the thing that constantly surprised me is how they had such of that American music sensibility in performance. Those big smiles, like the beat, the way that they all move together as a girl group that you might see forming in the US at that time. So it's quite remarkable how well trained they were and how they were able to capture the hearts of the American troops, because they loved to hear the American music being performed live and being performed well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And there are tons of pictures. I don't know if you got a chance to see them, but
no.
I actually ran across a couple of, or actually a lot of photos during that time. There's a lot of photos of the Kim sisters, even in Korea, when they were performing for the soldiers.
How cute.
And so it's just amazing how well documented, at least with photos, they are, especially during this time.
That is surprising.
Yeah.
Well, okay, to give an idea, this is about 1953 to 1958. They're doing the military circuit around the Korean Peninsula. And the American soldiers were writing home about them. And Tom Ball, who was a top music producer, I read that he planned the, quote, Asian show in Las Vegas. I don't know what that means. But anyway, he was a music producer. He heard about them.
Can't mean anything good.
Yeah, whatever that means. He flew all the way to Korea to see them perform in 1958. And apparently was totally like, wow, these girls have it. And I'm going to take them back to Las Vegas. And in 1959, he gave them a 4-week contract to perform at the Thunderbird Hotel. And this was kind of like the trial period. Mm-hmm. You got to do well during this 4 weeks. Long story short, they did do well.
Absolutely. And let's talk money, because they apparently were getting paid. And I think it's reported that they started making about $400 a week.
Okay.
And then
So
I was like, man, $400 a week, that's not a lot. But then I was thinking, you know what, Sed? How much would that be if you actually lived in the United States in 1958?
Yeah.
And so that is equivalent to $4,200.
No.
And in today's dollars, that's adjusted for inflation. So
that
is the purchasing power of that money at the time. Now, this is just me just Googling how much is $400 in 1958 in the US.
Okay.
And so just to give you an idea, $400 today is far different than before. So it's actually not that bad if my projection is correct.
Yeah, I was about to say that is actually incredible.
Right. But, you know, of course there's logistics, and not only that, but there's like, you know, we don't know how much they actually got from the $400.
Well, the other thing too, I read, I only found it in one source, that Tom Ball, who was their first manager, he exploited those girls. So I don't actually know how much money they actually received.
Exactly.
But he was taking advantage of their fame and success.
Oh, man. Yeah. I mean,
they were just teenagers.
Yeah.
They were so young. They didn't have parents with them. They were in a foreign country. They didn't speak English at all. They were fully reliant on this guy.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's really not a surprise that that's what happened at the beginning.
Absolutely.
But how it did happen, they were making $400 a week. They had that 4-week contract in Las Vegas, and they were a huge hit. Not only were they unique, I mean, they were Korean, they were also really fresh. They had great personalities. They were fantastic musicians. Before they left, you know, their mom was saying, there are lots of girl groups in Korea. You need to stand out. And that's where the whole instruments came into. And so, they could just play all these instruments. They looked great. everyone loved them and they were sold out. They would work 6 shows a night and during their free time, they just learned to play more instruments and they just practice and practice and practice. And I read they performed every night from midnight to 7 a.m. So quite an intense start
Absolutely.
To their career.
Yeah. So now, you know, they're in the States, they're performing constantly.
Yeah.
And I'd imagine, I mean, it looks like they're having fun with it, you know?
It does.
I mean, but they're clearly very professional.
Yeah.
But there's no doubt that there is some struggle involved,
yeah.
right? You know, if anything, with the transition from coming from Korea to the United States without the ability to speak English, I'm sure they learned over time, obviously. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you're away from home, you're away from your family, your brothers and your mother.
Yeah.
Right.
And I read that they really struggle with the food as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, you know, that's huge. If anybody has, you know, gone to a foreign country and moved there for a period of time, a lot of, you know, you would probably understand unless they had the food that you're accustomed to or that gives you comfort. Like you can, even food can give you big struggle and anxiety, you know? Mm-hmm. So they obviously had to adjust to America in their way of life. And, you know, as you mentioned, even financially, they were exploited by their producer.
Yeah.
Or I guess he managed them as well at the time. So, you know, with fame comes a lot of struggle.
Yeah, of course.
And this is a perfect example of that.
But they also made a lot of money.
Yeah, they did. So you found, I guess, that they ended up making about $15,000 a week?
Yeah. And this is in Las Vegas. After those 4 weeks, they got a longer contract. I mean, they worked for… I read from anywhere from 14 to 17 years as a completely sold out act.
Mm-hmm.
They were one of the most popular acts in Las Vegas throughout the 60s.
Yeah.
Like, this is how big they were. They performed in the Stardust, the Las Vegas Hilton, the Holiday Casino. They performed everywhere, sold out for all those years. And they were making $15,000 a week. And how much is that in today's dollars?
Well, according to my sources, that would equate to about $150,000.
That is mental.
A week.
Yeah.
Not a year. Not a month.
A week.
A week. Again, we don't know. I mean, we don't know exactly how that translates to, you know, their lifestyle or what they were actually receiving with their manager and, you know, just all the business stuff and them being exploited. But still, they were a money-making powerhouse regardless.
Yes. They were sending this money back to their family in Korea. So they were supporting their whole family in Korea. So to them, doing these performances was not just, oh, we're having fun and we're building fame. This was literally the lifeline to their family in their home country. So that was a big deal. I also read that they didn't travel back to Korea for a long time because they were afraid they wouldn't be able to come back to the US.
Hmm.
And I think that has to do with the exploitation, their manager. You know, who knows how honest he was with them? Who knows? They were so young. They didn't know like all of those things. Even when they first came to the US, they didn't even know how long the flight was and they didn't bring anything with them. They wore their hanboks to the airport. Like they didn't know a single thing about what was happening.
Yeah.
So anyway, they are making a lot of money. I also read that there was, I can't remember which year it was. I guess it was sometime in the 70s. They were the highest taxpayers in Las Vegas.
Wow, really?
At a time because they were making so much money. So it was reported in their tax earnings that they were the number one highest. Like who was it? Sukta maybe? Someone was the number one highest taxpayer in Las Vegas.
Well, I mean, then these numbers that we were talking, it's probably accurate or, you know, very close, if anything. That's crazy.
Well, let's talk just briefly about the kind of music that they were doing.
Okay.
So they learned rock and roll from the 8th Army Club in Korea, which is so cool to think about that. Like the 8th Army Club, I think it still exists today. Mm-hmm. Or I wish I had looked more into that. But anyway, if you know the Stars and Stripes newspaper that comes out from the American base in Korea, I'm sure they've written about these girls. And so this is the kind of music that they were doing. Those tight harmonies, you know, a trio, a lot of the… Yeah, they did a lot of takes of rock and roll. And they did lots of covers. So that's how they became really well known with their music.
Right. And they did everything exceptionally well.
Yeah, they really, really did.
For sure.
So they're doing really well in Las Vegas. And then their big break happens. You want to mention that?
So this is where… And this is perhaps outside of Las Vegas where their notoriety maybe have come from. Because at the time, one of the biggest variety shows was the Ed Sullivan Show.
Yeah.
Right. And even I knew about the Ed Sullivan Show. I mean, it's obviously way before my time, but the first time I was introduced to Ed Sullivan was seeing the Jackson 5 perform on there. There's iconic when they were doing, I think, I Want You Back, and then Who's Loving You?
Is that where they performed?
Yeah. So they performed that. I think that was their first television debut as a band, I believe. But anyways, so Ed Sullivan has been doing his thing from 1948 to 1971.
Yeah, longest running variety show.
Right. And so these variety shows, as I understand it, and again, I've mostly watched, you know, I've watched different artists like the Jackson 5. I mean, Cher had a variety show. Like they would do a lot of acting and performing, and it was like very theatrical and it was very comedic. Mm-hmm. And so that's the type of show that, you know, Ed Sullivan had.
Yeah.
And it was, I guess, one of the biggest, if not the most famous one.
Massively popular. Ed Sullivan. This is a show where a lot of musicians made their big break. Mm-hmm. A quick side note about Ed Sullivan, which again, I didn't know about this. But apparently he's kind of held up as a major figure during the civil rights movement. So as you imagine, 1948 to 1971, long time, he had direct access to the mainstream, aka white American audience, through television. And through his show, he would introduce a lot of black artists to the mainstream US for the first time. And this is where they made many of their big breaks, just like what you mentioned, the Jackson 5. I also heard in an interview with one of the girls that they said it was just timing. Like, the reason why we were able to do so well was timing. Ed Sullivan loved them. And I think the fact that Ed Sullivan was not as narrow-minded as typical white producers may have been or TV people, he allowed them a spot on his show, which is what gave them so much coverage. And yeah, so Ed Sullivan, he, despite lots of backlash from viewers and advertisers, he was someone who would not distinguish between musicians. Are you white? Are you black? Are you Asian? If you're good and talented and he likes you, you're on the show.
Yeah.
So he was really big on that. So I think that's pretty cool that he was the one who also gave these girls their first step into the American audience.
Like, right.
They might have been some of the first Asian acts Americans may have ever seen.
Yeah. Yeah. Potentially, for sure. And so these girls, they were, you know, still doing their thing in Las Vegas. And so they still came to the Ed Sullivan Show. Mm-hmm. Not only twice. But 22 times in total, which apparently is the most performances in the show's history
from an artist.
Yeah. Or a group. Yeah, so that's pretty cool. And if you actually look up on YouTube, the Ed Sullivan actually has a YouTube channel.
Oh, really?
Even though he's long gone, but he has a YouTube channel. Yeah. I don't know who runs it, but you know, a lot of the performances from the Kim sisters are actually on that channel.
Yes, you can watch them. And we highly recommend you watch them. Mm-hmm. They're all excellent. They were the first Asian group to appear on the Ed Sullivan Show. Yeah. So I know we love to talk about like, oh, BTS, Blackpink. They were the first, you know, Korean group to appear on Jimmy Fallon, whatever. The Kim sisters were first.
Absolutely.
They were way before those guys. And so, they performed with the Beatles, Elvis Presley, Frank Sinatra. They appeared alongside these huge, huge acts and names, and they held their own. You know, and after doing the Ed Sullivan Show, who apparently he was very supportive of them, to the point that he actually, whether it's true or not, it's rumored that he supported the visa for their mother to be able to finally come to the U.S. later on in the 60s. But yeah, he was a huge supporter of them. And so because of this what's the word? Like becoming known to people?
I guess their fame?
Yeah, I guess their fame, right? Mm-hmm. Due to this, they appeared on Life magazine, Time magazines, LA Times. Throughout the 60s, they were called the face of Korea. And their story and their success was actually used in Korea as well. I guess as sort of propaganda to show like, hey, this is the American dream. Right. And it was also another reason to, as you know, the political climate happening between the US and other parts of the world, this was helping validate America's decision to defend South Korea. Look at these great girls. This is South Korea. We have a role to protect South Koreans because look how awesome Kim sisters are. So, of course, it's not all pure just entertainment. They also were part of the political atmosphere, whether they're aware of it or not.
Very much so.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, they obviously, I don't know how obvious it is, but they, you know, might have played a part in a lot of, I guess, migrations of Koreans
sure.
to America.
Because if you see somebody like that, while they didn't speak any English, mm-hmm. you know, oh, but they look how big they made it in the U.S. I can make it too.
Right.
And they
making
were very 15K popular.
A week.
Yeah, why not? They were very popular in Korea. And they did eventually come back to Korea to perform, I think with their brothers as well. And they were just widely loved.
Yeah.
Which is really great to hear.
Yeah. Yeah. So definitely check out as many, you know, as many performances as you can.
Yeah.
It's on YouTube, on the Ed Sullivan channel, other channels as well.
Yeah.
Tons of pictures and photos during this time.
Yeah. So Billboard charts.
Yeah.
This is so cool. They did a cover of Charlie Brown and it ended up being number 6 on the top Billboard charts, which is another interesting fact because mm-hmm. I remember when BTS and everyone was like, wow, BTS first Korean song to be in the top 10 of the Billboards. They did it first.
Yeah, they absolutely did
they
it first.
They were there first. And it's such a great cover.
And I actually think, and I was trying to look this up, it's hard to find the info, but I did see on one video from a professor that was talking about the Kim sisters.
Yeah.
She had mentioned there was another song that was actually number 2 on the Billboard charts.
Oh, really?
And I heard the song. I don't know what the title of the song is, yeah. but actually I think it's on their first album.
Oh.
And part of the song is actually they're singing in Korean. I think the first verse they're singing in Korean, talking about kimchi.
Yeah.
And then they sing in English. And I think that went to number 2. Don't quote me on it. I'm trying to really find and verify that.
Yeah.
But potentially they had more than one hit on the Billboard charts.
Wow. That is so cool.
So that's insane.
And it's so crazy how forgotten this has been. And I think part of it has to do with the fact that they did a lot of covers. Mm-hmm. I think if the Kim sisters had written and released songs under their own name, you know, not just a cover of this person, cover of that person. They were wonderful covers for sure. But, you know, this was a song by the Kim sisters and this is what they're famous for, like the iconic song. I think they would have lasted longer in the mainstream mind.
Right.
Or pop culture memory. Yeah.
For sure. For sure. So why don't we talk a couple of, I guess, facts really relating to maybe their personal lives and
okay.
sort of the aftermath
yeah.
of, I guess, the height of the success.
Okay. Well, we did mention their mother came to visit them in the U.S. I don't know if she ended up staying in the U.S., but she did come, it looks like, in 1963. And it seems Ed Sullivan was the one who helped to get her visa to mm-hmm. be able to come to the U.S. on the stipulation that she would perform on the show. Which she did. And I'm so blown away. Just Inanyang, like, of course, she can be overshadowed by the success of her kids. But, I mean, really, you have to credit her for her own sheer talent. You see her perform. She's a Korean woman, only in Korea, mm-hmm. you know, with Korean sensibilities and Korean performance and doesn't speak English. Yet she came on the show to perform with her girls. And she does a great job. Like, she looks so natural. Wonderful voice. She does sing. So it's really cool. You can see that video. Definitely check it out. And I think it was just a year or two later she passed away. So mm-hmm. when she performed on the show, she was ill. And it just shows a credit to her showmanship and her professionalism. So it's a wonderful, wonderful thing to know that she was able to actually see them in their space of success before she passed.
All right. So let's talk about maybe a little bit of their personal lives as much as we know and can find.
Yeah.
So around circa 1967-ish, mm-hmm. They performed at New York's Waldorf Astoria Hotel.
Waldorf.
I have a hard time saying that word. Waldorf?
Yeah.
Waldorf? Waldorf Astoria Hotel. If that hotel still exists, which it might.
It does. It's yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry for butchering your name and your brand, but they performed there. And this is actually where Sukja or Sue met her husband.
Yeah.
And the thing is, they were banned.
Yeah.
From dating for about 4 years because they were afraid that that would break up the group.
The mom, she was like, do not date mm-hmm. because if you show like the group getting splintered off, you don't have the same power. Man, their mom, she was so smart.
Yeah.
Like, she had such great marketing mindset too, right?
I mean, it's, yeah.
Well,
I
that's
mean,
essentially what happens with K-pop idols today.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say, that's the same concept that a lot of groups and performers have today.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So they didn't date for 4 years, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess they all would, whenever they wanted to go on dates.
They all went together.
All the sisters. So I guess it worked out for the husband, yeah. Or the soon to be husband. But yeah, that's so cute. That was sort of the tight, restrictive nature of, I guess, their personal lives and relationships. Right, but nevertheless, they did end up getting married.
Yes.
And also in 1967, someone else got married.
Yeah. So Minja also got married. She met her husband. They were performing at the same hotel. And he plays the vibraphone. His name is Tommy Vick. He immigrated to the U.S. because of the Hungarian Revolution in 1956. So they're both musicians, met in the U.S. performing. And I guess she wanted to learn to play the vibraphone. Mm-hmm. So she was asking him. I don't know. My guess is she already played.
She was flirty.
Yeah, that's
she's
what I'm thinking.
That was her little tactic.
Teach me. I don't know how to play the vibraphone. One of my millions of instruments. So yeah, so that's what happened. And mm-hmm. they ended up getting married in 1967. And I think this is kind of the beginning of the splintering of the group. So Minja got married. It looks like Suja and Aja both got or all got married around the same time. And like you said, Suja met her husband while they were performing at the Waldorf Astoria
Waldorf.
Hotel. I'm kidding. Yeah, at that hotel. Yeah, and so after Minja got married, I think she was the one who stopped first. And it seemed like the other two then performed with their brothers.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Because I know that their stint in Las Vegas lasted until the early 70s.
Yeah.
Right? So yeah, I don't know what the environment in their relationship or dynamics were at the very end of that. But I know that they did actually, I think they performed in Korea in the early 70s or maybe mid 70s as well. I saw a video of that.
Yeah, and I think that's with their brothers. Like they were performing together.
Okay. Yeah.
That's when they went to Korea, did the performance. So the Kim brothers, which were the three brothers and then the one, who knows what he's doing. So the three brothers, Sukta and Aja, then they were performing together. And it looks like until the 90s. And they never reached the same height of success that they had in the 60s and 70s. But it's really cool to see that like they continued to perform and were still very beloved wherever they did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, Aja passed in 1987 mm-hmm. from lung cancer. Mm-hmm. And Mia ended up moving to, or Minja, yeah. Mia, ended up moving to Hungary with her husband.
Yeah.
And she actually continues to perform.
Yeah, you can still see her performing there. I read, it was either her or her husband said, they decided to leave America because the appreciation for true music did not exist anymore in this country.
Ooh, is the way that is a statement.
That it was said. In Hungary, people still appreciated, mm-hmm. like, music.
Yeah, we have thoughts on that.
Yeah, we have our thoughts on that as well. So anyway, she and her husband went to Hungary and they're still performing today. And they do like the vibraphone and stuff. So I guess that was the real center of their love.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Sue is reportedly still in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
And she is with her husband and she has children and also grandchildren.
Yeah. And she looks great, by the way. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So she's still there. And I think she still sings. She'll still perform in Vegas.
Man, that's awesome.
It's so cool. Yeah.
Yeah. So unfortunately, I think we've pretty much found out that they're, I don't want to use the word estranged, but they're not really, you know, they're not really like vibing together.
I think
you know, they don't meet up. I don't know. I don't know what their relationship is now.
A lot of this is like, oh, I read here, there.
Yeah.
There's no real like definitive thing I can find. It seems that they had a falling out near the end of the career of how much their husbands will get involved in the act.
Mm.
So their mom was right, really. Like once you get married or once you're with your partner, your loyalties shift.
Yeah.
A little bit. And I think that's kind of what happened here with Minja and Sukja. Like, how much should our husbands be involved with our group? And mm-hmm. so something went on there. They disagreed. And since then, it seems like they're not really in touch anymore. Yeah. So they had their golden years for sure as this incredible group. And then they went off and, you know, began the next chapter of their lives with their husbands and families. So like we mentioned earlier, there is a documentary that came out in 2015 called either Try to Remember is the English name or 다방의 푸른 꿈, which you remember is the song their father wrote for their mother way in the past. So you can check that out. And there's interviews that Sukja gives. I think Minja gives a few interviews as well. And you can hear a little bit more about their own story from their own mouths. And I did see, this was again, just one thing I found. Some director mm-hmm. named Kim Hyun-jun apparently was trying to bring their story to Broadway. I never saw that. come to fruition. I couldn't find anything up on that. Right. So maybe it happened. Maybe it's still ongoing.
It works. Mm-hmm.
But it seems like they're trying to do that, or they did try to do that. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Like I would love to see, like I couldn't help but to think like this would be such a great like biopic type of,
yeah,
or just you know, based on a true story type of, you know, yeah, movie or film.
Yeah, yeah.
I would love to see that.
It would be so cool. I have a quote from their mother, or I think Sukja is saying this about their mother in her older age. Sukja said that their mom used to always say, while you're singing, 속이 풀린다고 했어요. Like you feel refreshed inside, right? And then whenever you're singing, your heart will become comfortable and younger. And Sukja says, in my older age, I understand what my mother told me. So I love to see just the positive and strong influence their parents' musical talent and love, mm-hmm, carried on through the rest of their family.
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool. Sukja did say in an NBC News interview, they asked her, what was your favorite performance? And she mentioned she did a performance with Louis Armstrong. They did one. They were working at an American football field in Chicago. And when they performed, she said that she went up on the stage and there was 80,000 people packed into the stadium. Like they were big,
yeah,
you know, 80,000 people packed in this. And they performed with Louis Armstrong, one of the greatest performers of all time. They played the saxophone. The three girls did. They sang 20 minutes. It was magnificent. That is something I'll always remember. I cannot find this performance online. I think there's a lot of performances that you're not going to find online or on YouTube of them. But they definitely, I mean, they had great moments with great superstars whose names we still remember today.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. So again, so surprised that I didn't come across this or never really noticed.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. But I mean, perhaps some of you listening, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if one or two of you either know who they are or, yeah, came across the Kim sisters in one way or the other.
Yeah, absolutely. And if this is your first time hearing them, go and check out all their stuff as much as you can. They've got a lot of stuff on the Ed Sullivan. Check out their photos to kind of get an idea for their energy and their liveliness and their loveliness. They were a fantastic group. And for all purposes, they were the first K-pop girl group to appear in the United States. So they deserve their moment in history, in musical history.
And we're going to publicly give them flowers.
Oh, yes.
On behalf of
here
all
they are.
The Happy Project.
You
listeners.
May have them. They're from us. So that's the Kim sisters. Is there anything else that you wanted to add before we say goodbye?
No, I think we definitely covered it. I encourage you to just go down the rabbit hole like I did.
Yeah.
You know, on their performances. Just look up the Kim sisters on YouTube, yeah, and you'll find a bunch that'll keep you entertained for hours.
Exactly. There's only so much we can say to describe it.
Mm-hmm.
You got to see and hear with your own eyes.
Yeah.
And then you'll understand why they were such a sensation. All right, Kim sisters. Sukja-nim, Eja-nim, Min-ja-nim. Thank you so much for
you.
Your musical influence and for paving the way for Korean artists to be seen in the United States and around the world. We did get a listener mail, but I'm going to follow up with you separately. But if you want to send us emails that you are cool with us talking about on the podcast, you can always write in at thehaffyproject@gmail.com. You've got questions, you've got comments, you've got a fun story to share. You want to tell us who you think is the first real K-pop artist to appear in the US? You let us know. Maybe who you've got your favorite K-pop song or singer. Tell us who it is. And maybe it's someone new that we haven't discovered yet. I mean, it'll be hard for you to pull the wool over Cedric's eyes because he knows like every single K-pop group ever,
everything,
especially the girls.
Everyone.
You heard what he said.
Oh, yeah.
But if you think there's someone we don't know yet, your favorite Korean singer or whomever, you let us know at thehaffyproject@gmail.com. Also, make sure to keep checking out the website. I mean, we're always posting new stuff, new posts, new articles, my own blogging. There's a lot of cool things to check out. So that's thehaffyproject.com. Yeah, well, we're going to sign off here. Thanks so much for listening, you guys. And we'll hear you. We'll see you. I mean, we won't even see you.
But if you want to write in and give us your audio message, we'll hear you.
You will hear us. And if you write to us, we will see your message. Anyway, until next week, thanks for listening. We are The Happy Project.